From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Bella Bond's mother takes the stand. Rochelle Bond testifies against her boyfriend who's accused of the toddler's murder, but defense lawyers say it's the mother who's guilty. Also today, British authorities identify two of the three London attackers. The mayor of London speaks out.
And I'm angry and furious that these three men are seeking to justify their actions by using the faith that I belong to justify their actions.
Plus,
how do children learn to explore?
Yes, go, 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 go. Good job.
What if the best way to close the achievement gap is to hug your kids more? That's one of the lessons that a program called Boston Basics is trying to teach parents across the city. But we'll ask if improving parenting is the solution when the real problems might be poverty and racism. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Rochelle Bond, the mother of two-year-old Bella Bond, returned to the stand today to face cross-examination in the trial of her former boyfriend, Michael McCarthy. He's accused of murdering the toddler. Bond is testifying against McCarthy. It's part of a plea deal she struck with prosecutors. But today, defense attorney Jonathan Shapiro attempted to cast doubt on Bond's testimony, implying that she covered up her own daughter's murder. Shapiro asked Bond if she had lied about Bella's death, for example, in order to continue receiving state welfare benefits.
And you also certified to the people who were providing you with benefits that you had a daughter and she was living with you.
TAFDC, yes.
And as a result of that, you continued to receive benefits all summer.
Yes, that's why.
And that was a lie?
Yes.
Well, joining us now with more is Susan Zelkind. She's an executive reporter, investigative reporter covering the trial for the Daily Beast. And she joins us now. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So, Susan, first of all, what was the atmosphere in the courtroom today as Rochelle Bond gave her testimony?
I think everybody in this courtroom is fairly drained. This is one of the most horrific murder trials that I've ever heard in my life. I think that happens when there's a two-year-old girl who's been murdered, but there's also heroin. We're seeing the darkest part of the opioid epidemic, talk of demons and conspiracy theories. It was a tense, emotional day today, as it has been.
Rochelle Bond, as we mentioned, is testifying against Michael McCarthy as part of a plea deal she struck with prosecutors. But it seems as if defense attorneys spent a long time today, you know, trying to cast doubt on the testimony that Bond offered. What happened?
Well, Bond's story is that Michael McCarthy murdered her daughter and then took her daughter and her, knocking her out by hitting her in the head and then dumping the child into the ocean by way of South Boston. Now, her problem is she doesn't remember the exact date that happened. And the story is, how could you not remember the day that your daughter died? And her story is that she was so high on heroin that all the days after that just seemed to swarm together. And that she's changed her story. We found out that she, and this was actually from the prosecution. I think the prosecutor in the opening arguments tried to step in front of the undercutting that the defense is about to do by having her say that, you know, at first when she spoke to police, she said that the child was in the trunk of the car when actually it was in the back seat. At first she said it was in May. Actually, the child died in June. And her excuse for that is that she was so high on heroin, and then when she spoke to police was withdrawing from heroin, that she got a lot of her information confused.
Huh, interesting. Well, I mean, to that point, it was under questioning from Suffolk Assistant DA David Deacon that Bond said that she had considered going to authorities after the murder of her daughter, but didn't. So let's listen to that.
I looked up the FBI on my phone.
And why the FBI?
Because this is a big deal. I just thought that was the appropriate.
Did you go to the FBI?
I didn't end up going, no.
What did Rochelle Bond say about why she didn't go to the authorities after her daughter had been killed?
Well, we begin to hear her story of how she felt trapped by Michael McCarthy. She says after he killed her daughter, he followed her everywhere, and I mean everywhere, into the bathroom, into the shower. And we heard a little bit from the messages that they shared back and forth of ways that McCarthy could have been potentially abusive, swearing at her constantly. And then she says she didn't go to the authorities at first because she was scared, and then as the days went on, she was scared that nobody would believe her, that she would be pinned for the crime, and all that McCarthy had at her home were his bottles of prescription pills with his name on it, and then he could take those and then just disappear, and she would be pegged with her daughter's murder.
Well, I mean, but even though she struck this plea deal with prosecutors, isn't that kind of what the defense is trying to do under with their cross-examination of her? I mean, didn't Jonathan Shapiro today, correct me if I'm wrong, basically come out and say that, you know, she's as much to bear the guilt for Bella's death as anybody?
Oh, totally. I mean, there's two stories that you hear here. One is that Michael McCarthy went to the hospital. Up until then, he'd been totally controlling and manipulating Rochelle Bond. And once he went to the hospital, she was free. She ran away, didn't pay his parking meter, and wasn't coming back. And so finally, she's escaped. The other story that you hear at this time is that Bella Bond's dad starts knocking on her door, asking where his child is, and Jonathan Shapiro says, this is when you realize the gig was up. You had to do something. You'd been lying all summer to everybody you knew, including under oath and in court, that your daughter was elsewhere or your daughter was with you, making up different stories. And now that Bella Bond's dad wanted to see his kid, you knew you couldn't lie anymore. Jonathan Shapiro is talking now about how previously, though Bella Bond's dad had never met his daughter, that he had called the Department of Children and Families on her twice before with various concerns about how she was taking care of their child, and that she was worried that he would do that again and she would be found out.
Mm. And Susan, one more question, because you mentioned drug use again being a major theme in this trial. What more did we discover or learn today about Rochelle Bond's own use of heroin? Because, I mean, in the immediate aftermath of the public discovering who Bella Bond was, there were all these stories about Rochelle Bond saying she was forcibly injected with heroin by Michael McCarthy, et cetera. Did that whole story hold up in court today?
We heard that before the trial, that she was forcibly injected. Now we're hearing that after Michael McCarthy killed her daughter, she welcomed him injecting her with heroin because she wanted to numb the pain, essentially. We heard about them doing between 2 to 4 ounces of heroin a day, injecting themselves between 4 and 7 times. I think heroin and opioid addiction is a part of every single step in this case. You hear about people being sick, needing drugs, looking for drugs. That's how the different characters in the story meet, is in their quest for drugs. This is very much a story about the opioid epidemic.
What an awful tragedy on all fronts. Well, Susan Zelkind, investigative reporter covering the trial of the murder of Bella Bond. She's doing that for the Daily Beast. Susan, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. British authorities have released the names of 2 of the 3 men accused of the London terrorist attack on Saturday. That attack killed at least 7 people. 27-year-old Khurram Shahzad Butt was a Pakistani-born British citizen. 30-year-old Rashid Redouane had claimed to be Moroccan and Libyan, according to Scotland Yard. Now, they may have been known to authorities. Butt was a supporter of what British press is saying is a banned Islamist group in the UK. And last year, he was featured in a British documentary titled The Jihadis Next Door. Meanwhile, today, London's mayor Sadiq Khan lashed out against the attackers.
The acts of these 3 men on Saturday night was cowardly, was evil. And I'm angry and furious that these three men are seeking to justify their actions by using the faith that I belong to justify their actions.
Well, at the same time, President Donald Trump continued his Twitter screed against Khan, tweeting today, quote, pathetic excuse by London Mayor Sadiq Khan, who had to think fast on his no reason to be alarmed statement. MSM is working hard to sell it. Well, that's the president mentioning in a tweet where he had taken Khan's words out of context. The mayor had actually told Londoners there's no reason to be alarmed about the increased police presence in the UK capital following the terrorist attacks. Well, much to wrap our heads around, so let's get some perspective here. Joining us now is Adil Najam. He's dean of the party, or founding dean of the party School of Global Affairs at Boston University. Professor Najam, welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm sorry, I'm trying to keep up with the pace of the news here, and sometimes it's a little harder than I think it should be. But let me just first of all get your reactions to all this happened in the UK. I mean, you're a key member of the Muslim community here. What do you make of it?
I think there's a lot of fear. I think there's a lot of concern, not just about what's happening in the UK, but really what's happening around the world. And all of these things are connected. In the UK, of course, this happens right on the eve of an election that they have decided will go on, an election that could possibly be impacted in some way, to some extent, by this. But I think the repercussions, as you mentioned, especially with the tweet war the president of the US wants to have with the mayor of London, is that we are living in a different world. We are living a different world, and that causes a lot of fear for a lot of people about what might happen. This morning, there was a shooting at Florida, mm-hmm. and I kid you not, I was pacing around the room to figure out what was happening. And it's not even in the news. You know, six people get killed. It's supposedly, right. This is not terror. You can cause terror, but not be a terrorist. It's linked to how we have treated the news in Orlando, not in Orlando, but in Portland, mm-hmm. Oregon.
Right.
And when does someone become a terrorist? Does being a Muslim, is that a necessary condition for that? And if I might go on a limb here, not on a limb really, is the statements around Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London, because he's not just the mayor of London, he's a Muslim mayor mm-hmm. of London. The mayor of Manchester a few weeks ago made just exactly the same statement, didn't seem to elicit the same reaction. So there is a lot of concern on what has happened.
Well, so let's talk about that more for just a moment here, because, I mean, in that tape that we played of Mayor Sadiq Khan, you heard him personally react. He was saying that he's infuriated at these attackers for using the very same faith that he practices to justify, you know, murdering people crossing London Bridge. And I don't see why people shouldn't pay special attention to the fact that sure. Khan is saying this, because he is speaking as a member of the Muslim community in the UK.
Oh, yes. I think what he's saying, I don't think there's a surprise in what he's saying.
Right.
I think the surprise is what the President of the United States is saying. But, you know, what Sadiq Khan was saying is something that I've heard now every time since 9/11. I have said that on this table many times, in these studios many times. That is how every Muslim feels. You don't even have to be Muslim. That's how every Londoner feels. But I think we are coming to a world where even those of us who are trying so hard not to be compartmentalized mm-hmm. in these silos are just finding the forces that would force that upon us
okay.
to be too strong.
Okay, so I want to come back to that in a second. Mm-hmm. But I just want to play a little bit of tape from Prime Minister Theresa May, because, again, it feels as if, I don't know if I'm reading too much, but the language is getting sharper out of the UK than perhaps we've heard before, and maybe that's because this is the third attack in such a short period of time in the UK. But here's a little bit of what Prime Minister Theresa May has said.
Since the emergence of the threat from Islamist-inspired terrorism, our country has made significant progress in disrupting plots and protecting the public. But it is time to say enough is enough.
But enough has always been enough. Enough has been enough after each one of those attacks. I don't know how this one is any more enough than that. She's exactly right. More needs to be done. But where I think they're wrong is in the clip that you did play, that Muslims somehow have to do something about this. Yes, they do, but the same way that everyone else has to do. That's like saying that anyone who's white or who's Christian has to do something about the Jeremy Christian, the guy in Portland, mm-hmm. who went on this rampage. That is true, but that doesn't mean others don't have to. I think what the connection that is being made, then the connection that is disturbing, is that somehow this is the responsibility of every one of the 1.8 billion Muslims around the world. And I think what is left not even unstated, because it's now becoming more and more stated, that there is something wrong with Muslims as a species. And I think that is not just wrong and is not just offensive. It is very, very dangerous. And that scares all of us Muslims who are as outraged or more, because we are scared for our kids. You know, I think the really important thing is what's happening to a teenager in high school. I have two kids of my own. I am more scared for them today than I was ever after 9/11.
Specifically why?
Because of what they hear
from
everyone around them, and because of what they might say, because these are teenagers. I think it is extremely tough to be Muslim and a teenager today. Actually, I think it's very tough to be an immigrant and a teenager. I think it's just always tough to be a teenager. But we are creating a narrative through the media, through these tweets, through our politics, that is going to impact these young people, not just for 4 years of one president or the other, not just for one election cycle or another. Those who are in high school today, they are going to be tainted for their entire life.
But what could the impact of that be? I mean, what could the impact of that be on, you know, your own kids?
I think some of the best, strongest, most important values that we have built our societies on are being threatened by this narrative. The value of diversity, the value of questioning, the value of truth, the value of being able to live with differences, the value of being able to celebrate those who might be against you. Mm. So think about, you know, these are kids who are hearing all of this, right? Even if they have NPR on, I sometimes now have to turn NPR off because my kids are at the back of the car.
Yeah.
Because these are impressionable minds. And it's not just my kids because they are Muslims. If they're not Muslims, any kids, we are creating a poisoned narrative.
But let me ask you a question. So I take your point about absolutely not tarring an entire faith, an entire global faith, because of the, you know, the disgusting actions of a diminishingly small minority. But you also made the point of, you know, we don't hold, for example, all of Christianity responsible when, I don't know, in years past, someone shot up an abortion clinic in the name of Jesus Christ, for example. But am I also hearing you saying that maybe we should? Because I think why not? Why not?
But we don't have to go to that past, right? So guy in Portland, right? I mean, he did what he did avowedly even after the event in the name of what he believes to be right Christian values. It would be wrong. It would be absurd for me to then say, now every Christian in the world has to respond to that. Now, none of this is to say that Muslims don't have a responsibility. Not a responsibility, but a special role. I worry about this because this radicalization could impact my own kids.
But so that's exactly right? The point, right? Like, I think people are saying, they're not saying, okay, not, let's not malign the entire global Islamic community, but can we not ask what is the responsibility of
yes, but when
individual
you ask,
families in communities like, you know, in East London,
yes,
for example.
But the assumption in that question is that they are doing nothing. They're just sitting there clapping when these things happen. You know, we have a president who actually believes they dance, Muslims dance when these things happen. And that is not just absurd, it's nonsense. It is. You get an attack anywhere, like the one in Florida today, and every Muslim is on edge, because the repercussion could be personal for them. So this assumption, this insulting assumption, that we have to ask this question because otherwise they are doing nothing. Mm. Right? So we get the answer 1,000 times. We don't want to believe it.
But there is a war of ideas going on in the minds of some people, though, is there not? I mean, Theresa May also recently said that, you know, that radical extremism would only be defeated when, in her words, we turn people's minds away from this violence and make them understand that our values, pluralistic British values, are superior to anything offered by the preachers and supporters of hate.
I think that is correct. But that statement should not just be for Muslims who get to go towards extremist violence, right? It is equally true for anyone who tilts towards violence and extremism, and violence as a means of finding the solution to what they want out of life, right? And that should be equally true. I think that war of ideas is our defining war, and it is not just a Muslim war. It is very much a Muslim war. If you talk to Muslim parents here in Boston or elsewhere, they are more worried than anyone else I know about this, because this radicalization is very immediate to them.
Mm-hmm.
The threat to them is to their own children, right? So the absurdity, I think, is in the notion, in the assumption, that we have to ask this question because if we don't ask, they won't do anything. If we don't ask, they aren't doing anything. Or we are asking because we think they aren't doing anything. For 20 years now, we have been talking about what is being done. It's not working. That is true. It's not working within Muslims. It is not working within non-Muslims. It is not working within the U.S. It is not working within the French or the British or anywhere else. So, but what I think the problem with this rhetoric is it actually strengthens those who would divide, whether they be ISIS,
right,
or whether they be supremacists elsewhere.
So how then, or where then, is the counter-messaging, if I can call it that, going to come from when... for example, Theresa May was asked by half a dozen reporters in a recent press conference, if she would like President Donald Trump to stop his attacks on Sadiq Khan, and she wouldn't criticize Trump at all. She avoided the question entirely. So that's a policy of avoidance, for example, on one hand, from the UK Prime Minister, and then of course we have our own president here right now, who has taken the opportunity of the death of seven more people in London to renew his call for travel ban and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm just wondering, that is the dominant political messaging coming from multiple places right now. Where is the counter messaging going to come from?
If I knew, the world would be a better place if anyone knew. But we keep trying. I think it's going to come from you. And I think it's going to come from your listeners. And I think it's going to come out of many, many times. And it does come. The question, it's not that the voice isn't there. It's being drowned out by other voices. Right. So imagine, for example, again, in a blue sky world, all religious extremism from the so-called Muslim groups that are trying to co-opt Islam in the name of terror suddenly stops tomorrow. Would the problem go away? No, because now we have as many or more people who have built their own reservoirs of hate against all Muslims based on this,
uh-huh,
right? So I think when any of these attacks happen, it strengthens not just those who are doing the attacks. It also strengthens the narratives of those whose putrid hatred is equally based on this. So in some ways, there is this conspiracy between the extremes,
yeah,
that is just taking the middle and squeezing it, not just between a rock and a hard place, but a rock and a rock and a rock and another hard place.
Yeah.
And if you are a Muslim, but you don't have to be a Muslim, if you're anyone, you feel squeezed by that. On Theresa May, very, very briefly. Now, recall that when Sadiq Khan was elected, his being a Muslim was not inconsequential. It was a very major part of that narrative in very ugly ways from Theresa May's party itself,
mm-hmm,
and she is facing an election. So in many ways, I think there is a putrid politics, there is the reality of terror, not just in the name of Islam, but terror on trains in Portland, terror in marketplaces,
mm-hmm,
and all of that is conspiring to really bring down. The one thing she's right is the values that societies have been built on for the last 50 years are under threat.
Well, then it's up to people of good faith and reason to speak out as much as possible. Adil Najam, founding dean of the Pardee School of Global Affairs at Boston University, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, we're having some gloomy weather today, and this kind of weather always makes me just want to crawl into bed with a good book and then take a nap. And lo and behold, there's actually an entire conference about sleep going on right now in Boston. And Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog, was at the conference where researchers are presenting some of the latest insights into catching Z's, how it works, and how to fix it when it all goes wrong. Carrie, help me. How do we fix it? No. So give me some of the takeaways from this big sleep conference.
So first of all, I second your motion for a nap and a book. I'll raise you a hot chocolate.
Oh, I'm in.
Yes. And actually, I have a takeaway about sleep from even before this conference. So my family stayed at a major hotel chain over this last weekend, and it was like they were marketing a cult of sleep. Like they were boasting about their circadian mood lighting for guests to personalize the in-room light environment to enhance sleep.
Wait, isn't AKA just turning the lights off?
You mean, yeah, turn the lights off when you want to go to sleep, yes. But they also had a dawn simulator to gently wake you and long wave night lighting to minimize sleep disruption.
Okay, well, I'm intrigued, to be honest, but I guess the point is that many people are deeply obsessed with getting better sleep, and there's a market emerging around this?
It certainly seems so. I mean, sleep is an eternal topic, right? And it's an even bigger one lately. It's estimated that about 60 million Americans have insomnia every year. So it really is no surprise that the sleep research conference that's going on right now at the Heinz Convention Center, it's called Sleep 2017 with the sleep all in uppercase letters, like Sleep 2017. It's drawing something like 7,000 researchers to the Heinz this week.
There must be a very powerful subconscious suggestion about saying the word sleep because I just yawned. And yes. It's nothing personal, Carrie. It's nothing personal. Now, okay. The big research conference is like this. Lots of interesting studies. So obviously 7,000 researchers there. What are your picks about some big finds or studies?
Well, so one that really grabbed me is a preliminary study out of MIT that looks at sleep among college students.
Okay, so as in not much of it, pulling all-nighters up until 3 a.m., blah, blah,
right.
blah, blah, blah.
Right. And one interpretation of this study is that if you, as a college student, feel compelled to go to bed at 3 a.m., at least make it a regular habit to go to bed at 3 because it's looking like that would be better for your feelings of happiness and well-being, especially in the morning and evening, than if you bounce around more sleep-wise. And I spoke with Akane Sano. She's in the Media Lab's Affective Computing Group at MIT. She says the findings suggest that this regularity in your sleep is mainly important if you're a short sleeper, like less than 7 hours a night.
What we found is irregular sleepers who sleep less than 7 hours. So if they switch to regular sleep, their health and well-being dramatically improved.
So your health will be dramatically improved. But she says if you're getting over 7 hours of sleep a night, that regularity doesn't seem to matter much.
Okay, so I guess we're in summer now, so maybe this doesn't matter to students at all. But next time, maybe when they're heading into finals for fall semester and they feel like they can't afford to sleep more than 4 hours a night, maybe they just pick the same 4 hours a night?
Maybe. I mean, these are totally preliminary studies. You can play around with preliminary preliminary findings all you want. But, you know, stress can get so heavy in college that whatever might help seems good. And this finding is part of a really interesting bigger study called Snapshot that's tracking about 300 New England college students, both their emotional states and their physical states using, you know, sensors on physical fitness like type trackers, and their social networks. And they're looking for signals that could predict that an emotional crisis is brewing so they could try to head it off.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, it may be those very social networks that are keeping them awake, but that's a side comment.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now what else from the sleep conference?
Okay, so how about baseball and sleep?
Baseball and sleep. How about that?
Okay. So what would you say, Meghna, if I told you that preliminary results out at this conference suggest that sleeping just one extra hour a night for 5 days before a game could significantly improve even a major league baseball player's reaction times?
Yeah, I'd say cool.
Okay, could help the Red Sox, right? So this is research being presented today, actually, at the Sleep Conference by Sherry Ma. She's a research fellow at the University of California, San Francisco Human Performance Center. And she led a randomized control trial of 17 pro ball, so major league ball players, at a four-week training camp. So she got their baseline, like how much they usually sleep, and then she randomized them to either 5 nights of their usual sleep or 5 nights where they basically went to bed early. Or what she calls sleep loading.
Is that akin to carbo loading before a marathon?
Yes, exactly.
But it is?
Oh, yeah, okay. It is. But it's sleep loading because you're not making up for a deficit. You're just adding more. So these guys, they normally average a little over 6 hours a night. The loading put them closer to 7 hours a night. And when Ma tested them with a bunch of cognitive tests, the sleep loading players improved by like 13% on a test of mental reaction speed. And they were also faster on an attention test where they had to ignore a distraction. And now they were differences of just a few dozen milliseconds, but milliseconds matter when a fastball is rocketing right at you. Here's Sherry Ma.
We do speculate that there may be application to the general public, but obviously we need to better study sleep loading in other populations. At the end of the day, we all require healthy and adequate sleep. And so this is one suggestion that additional rest opportunities may be beneficial for daytime functioning.
Okay, Kara, I'm going to just say here that while this is interesting, it's not necessarily new, right? Because, well, I was looking back at our own archives here at Radio Boston, and in 2014, we talked with sleep guru Charles Seisler at Harvard Medical School, who'd been hired by the Bruins to help get them on a good sleep regimen, and it got them that wasn't the only thing, but they're saying it's one of the things that maybe helped them get to the Stanley Cup
that year. That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, what's amazing to me, these guys are pro athletes. Like, they're so pampered and cared for, and yet they might actually, or her findings suggest, they weren't actually getting enough sleep. Like, how could they neglect that?
Yeah, you know what's so interesting is Seisler had told the Bruins in 2014 that maybe actually one of the things he wanted them to do was take a nap, a midday nap every day to help get them more sleep.
Wow.
Okay, so anyway, so this,
yeah,
so, you know, all overall, though, it's what was just said, like more sleep may be better for you while you're awake. So you got another study?
Yes. So one more. This one, at first I thought, oh, this belongs in the Journal of Da.
That's my favorite journal.
For many of us. Because the headline was, bed partners may unintentionally contribute to the perpetuation of insomnia, research shows. So of course I thought, well, of course your spouse snores, your kids kick you, right? So of course they contribute to your insomnia. But it turns out that this is actually about the partners of people with insomnia, and that a lot of partners are made be trying to be supportive, but actually contradicting what's best for the insomniac.
Okay, so what are they doing wrong then?
Well, the study says 74% of them would encourage the person with insomnia to go to bed early or wake up late, which is actually in contradiction to the top recommendations. And they said a lot of them would suggest like reading or watching TV in bed, and over a third suggested naps or caffeine or reduced daytime activities.
I know what you're about to say. All bad ideas.
I mean, apparently if you have chronic insomnia, right, that many of the recommendations recommend against this. But what was interesting, the point wasn't to blame the partner. The point was to say that maybe these programs that try to help people with sleep problems should really be looking at what their partners do as well as part of the treatment program.
Okay, so on a serious note, this makes sense, Kara, because you said earlier that some 60 million Americans have insomnia. So, I mean, the better help we can get for them, the better we all are.
Exactly, right. And, you know, that's my overarching feeling about this conference, that, you know, on the one hand, you go into the exhibit halls and you see that more than ever, sleep is an industry. I mean, they have the ultimate pillow, the ultimate high-tech shirt for monitoring your sleep, high-tech glasses that claim to be able to adjust your body clock. And then there are the drug makers, of course, too.
Right. I mean, I'm a huge business, billions and billions of dollars, I presume.
Yes. But at the same time, you know, there are all these research sessions going on about sleep medicine and sleep science and how sleep reacts with everything from the immune system to memory to psychiatric disorders. And I don't know about you, but for me, all it takes is one bad night of sleep to wish desperately that we understood this better.
Absolutely. And I would say that there's an equally large or a very large business working in opposition to sleep, because I once read a little while ago that Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, said one of their biggest competitors, Netflix's biggest competitors,
yeah,
is sleep.
Oh, that's
what
evil.
He said. And I say that because I'm currently, don't do what I do, everyone, I am binge watching House of Cards in bed
at
like 1
that.
In the morning. But anyway, Carrie,
that's doubly bad.
That's terrible.
For you.
I mean, especially after hearing all this. Yeah. Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog, thank you as always.
You're welcome, and enjoy your nap.
Maximize love
and manage stress.
Talk, sing,
and point.
Count, group,
y compare.
Explore through
movement and play.
Read and discuss stories.
Well, those are the five parenting principles that researcher Ronald Ferguson calls the Boston Basics. They're designed for children between birth and age 3, those critical first years of life, in which 80% of the brain's overall growth actually occurs. Now, the Boston Basics campaign is backed by organizations such as the Black Philanthropy Fund, the Boston Medical Center, the Achievement Gap Initiative at Harvard, and the city of Boston itself. They're partnering with hospitals, community health centers, childcare providers, libraries, early learning centers across the city with the goal of saturating the city of Boston with Boston Basics parenting principles. And Ferguson hopes that they can help close the achievement gap that already begins to emerge by the time a child hits kindergarten. Well, Ronald Ferguson joins us now. He's director of the Achievement Gap Initiative at Harvard, and he's creator of the Boston Basics. Professor Ferguson, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit more. Boston Basics is this citywide plan, but what exactly, how does it work?
Okay. Let me first say that the source, the inspiration for this project is noticing in the national data that racial and socioeconomic skill gaps are in place by the age of 2.
Two.
Right. Okay. So we're talking about not even halfway to kindergarten, and the gaps are pretty stark. As lead of the Achievement Gap Initiative at Harvard, most of our focus has been on kindergarten through college.
Yeah, so when we're saying 2-year-old skill gaps, are we talking about like speech and cognition, numeracy?
Yes, we're talking about how children respond to various types of stimulation. So, for example, language processing speed. You put several objects in front of a child, you name one of the objects, and you wait to see how long it is before the child looks at the object that you've named, because they have to hear it, make sense of it, then associate it. Children from the least advantaged backgrounds are already 6 months behind in language processing speed by the age of 2. We're talking about 6 months behind the most advantaged children.
And the differences then correlate to achievement gaps later?
Well, the differences then correlate to other elements of skills that build on language processing speed. So we're talking about, for example, the ability to pay attention in class. There are gaps in attention skills as of kindergarten that predict gaps in things like special education placements and skill and basic reading and math skills and behavior even. It turns out that misbehavior in kindergarten does not predict misbehavior in fifth grade, but attention skills in kindergarten predict misbehavior by fifth grade.
I see.
And so we're talking about a whole progression of skill development where one skill builds on another and really has to do with laying the foundations for lifelong learning.
So what Boston Basics sort of asserts or posits is that there are things that parents can do in a child's first days, months, weeks of life to close that gap that you say emerges by the time they're 2 years
old. Yeah, or to stop the gap from opening in the first place.
To stop the gap. And so what are these things?
Okay, so we know that the science is actually pretty good in giving us directions to go in to helped give children the early childhood lived experiences that help their brains to develop, that help their attitudes and skills to become what they need to be. And we have we put together a national advisory committee that helped us boil down a lot of the science into these five things, five clusters of parenting practices that we call the Boston Basics, and more generally now just the Basics, because it's already spilling out to other cities, and we just put the other city's name in it in front of it and rebrand everything. For example, the Chattanooga Basics.
Okay.
Right. And so the first of the basics is to maximize love and manage stress. It turns out that feeling secure as an infant and a toddler is foundational for what's called executive function skills, the ability to form and follow through on an intention. For example, children need to feel safe and loved and secure. So, for example, that means shielding a baby from stress. If there is arguing in the house, if the parents are really feeling stressful, take the baby out of the room, give them to another adult to hold. And the management of stress is as much about managing the caregiver or the parent's stress as it is about managing the baby's stress.
Well, we actually have a little clip from one of the I'll still call it the Boston Basics maximizing love and managing stress. And in this clip, you'll hear a mother telling an interviewer about her relationship with stress.
I'm going to have a very honest moment. I am stressed a lot. But I think one thing I've learned is to get out every day and to just let it go.
So is it as simple as like you said, teaching parents to, like, you know, put the baby in another room or giving themselves that break? I mean, it seems very elementary, basic to take the word of the program. I mean,
there are lots of folks who say, well, when people are not well off, when they are under financial and relationship strains, they just don't have the bandwidth to pay attention to these things. So it's not that simple. But my view is, well, let's at least share this and let them decide. And we hear people all the time saying that some of these things they just didn't know. They didn't think about them. And now that they're more aware, they can manage their lives more easily. Mm-hmm. The young lady who you just heard on that clip is married. Her husband is a firefighter. And we also have him in the video saying that when he gets home, he tries to kind of gauge how stressed she is. Uh-huh. And he will try to relieve her of some of that stress, to take it off of her, to figure out what it is he can do.
So let me ask you a question about something you raised there, because this is something that I had been wondering all day long, that some of the things that cause overwhelming, genuine stress in the lives of struggling parents,
right,
you know, are those things like poverty or
exactly.
job stress, or maybe there are challenges in the neighborhoods that they live in.
Right.
You know, whatever. There are lots of things that you can't. Even if you close your front door and you come into your house at the end of the day, the problems don't stay outside the door. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And so I do. I just want to ask you a little bit more about that. Like, it seems as if there are overwhelming challenges that, in the case of managing stress, this taking a break or gauging how your partner's doing isn't really going to make
we
a significant enough of a difference.
We can't use those as excuses not to share this knowledge with parents. And once parents know that it really matters that they protect their child from stress, they will take extra steps to try to avoid that, even if they are still stressed. In that same video that you were just talking about, there's a mother who just says, just hold your baby close and take deep breaths is a way to kind of relax it, relax yourself. But I have this mental image of stress radiating out from a parent, just like, you know, some kind of rays, and the saying, don't let your stress cook your kid.
Oh, my God.
Right?
Yeah.
And so there are lots of things in the world that make life difficult, but we can't wait until we fix all of those things before we go directly to intervene in the child's lived experiences. And we've got parents on tape who live in homeless shelters and who say, we just didn't know it mattered.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? One woman said, I didn't know it mattered that you paid a lot of really attention to your kid and talk to them and read with them. And she said, I've been doing it more now. She's got a 4-year-old and a 5-month-old. And we've got her on tape saying she's doing it more. And the 4-month-old is talking so much more and making up stories. And another woman similarly is talking about taking her little boy to the park and watching him explore. I mean, the fourth of the basics is explore through movement and play.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the stress relief that they're experiencing is through seeing their children get turned on when they do these things differently.
Right. So let's talk a little bit more about the one you were just mentioning about talking and singing and pointing, because there has been a lot of research specifically about the importance of lots of verbal communication in the youngest years with children. I mean, people were even calling it the word gap, right? In terms of the number, the language.
Exactly, 30 million words by the age of three.
Yeah, depending on cultural background or socioeconomic background. So I want to play a little clip here again. This is from the Talk, Sing, and Point video from Boston Basics, where a parent explains why she sings to her child.
Children love singing and love the rhythm, and they remember the song, and so they're able to participate. One green and speckled frog, sitting on a speckled log, eating the most delicious bugs. Yum, yum.
I love how she gets singing in there.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit more about the importance of song, actually.
Well, singing is a way to get kids' attention. It's unusual. It's enjoyable. And so it's all about transmitting verbal communication. Children can hear 3 months before they're born. So they've been in there listening 3 months before they even come out. They come out preferring their mother's voice and speech in their mother's native language. There's a video that shows that French and German babies whimper in the pattern of their mother's native language. Huh. One whimper ends with an uptick, the other ends with a downtick. And so we want people to talk real language from the very beginning, even if they're going to talk parentese, which is that high sing-songy tone of voice that gets babies to tune in. And the pointing piece is fascinating research that shows if you point at what you're talking about, your infant will more quickly pick up the idea that the thing you're pointing at is related to the sound you're making. They'll start to associate words and objects.
Right. So there was talk, singing, pointing, counting, group, and comparing objects,
and then
exploring through movement and play that you talked about.
Right.
I mean, we could spend a long time diving deep into these
each one
of these, but I did want to get some clarity from you on how is this program being deployed? I mean, is it like something that parents are supposed to be encountering at prenatal appointments? And where? Like, where is this information
coming?
All
the above. We've got a coalition in Boston. This grew initially out of the Achievement Gap Initiative at Harvard. To make a long story short, the Black Philanthropy Fund, a group of senior African Americans came together, wanted to find ways to give back. They, of all the things they looked at, this is what really captured their imagination. At first, we were going to do one neighborhood. Then they decided they wanted to do it citywide, and they wanted to lead it. And using a lot of their contacts at WGBH and the mayor's office and Boston Medical Center and the Children's Museum, we pulled together a lead coalition of organizations. And then more than 100 other organizations now have signed on. But what we're doing is working through existing organizations, existing social networks, and existing contacts. So it's not a new program in terms of a new site for services delivery. What it is, it's a new conversation.
Right.
It's putting in video and text and app kinds of resources that support a different conversation between a pediatrician and a patient, or a minister and a congregation, or a librarian and their customers. So there are about 12 sectors around town where we are working through those sectors to change the norms regarding what people do and talk about. And so you mentioned prenatal. So that's where it might start. So you get introduced in prenatal training. You get another reminder when you leave the hospital with a newborn and each time you go back for a well baby visit. Meanwhile, grandma goes for her annual checkup and they ask her if she's got grandkids. And her grandkids doing the basics. And she may come home from church after hearing a sermon on the basics. Everybody goes to any public library in the city, and they see some attention being called to the basics and things that they can read and watch. And so you think even barbershops, every place that touches people repeatedly, we want to be part of the basics community.
Professor Ferguson, I've got one more question for you, and it sort of circles back to something we talked about earlier, because I can't fully let it go. Because on the one hand, we should all support what could be highly effective early interventions like this, right? But on the other hand, I hate to say it, but it still seems kind of – am I wrong to say that it feels a little – are we being a little patronizing to these parents and saying like, hey, there's this really basic stuff you could do to make a big difference in your kids' lives and you didn't know about it?
I raised three boys. Some of these things I didn't know about. Okay, read and discuss stories. We read stories, but we didn't discuss stories. Uh-huh. Okay, count, group, and compare. I'm not sure we played grouping games as self-consciously as we might have. Talk, sing, and point. We talked a lot, But we didn't think about the fact that when we were singing, we were also teaching language, and we didn't point with purpose. Right. Okay. Love and manage stress. Maybe my household's not that stressful, so maybe it wasn't that big a deal for us. But some of the skill gaps we're talking about also pertain to more middle-class folks.
Right.
And some of our most enthusiastic respondents are upper-middle-class white women who are just thrilled that these are good reminders for the things they need to do.
Well, Ronald Ferguson is director of the Achievement Gap Initiative at Harvard University and the creator of Boston Basics. We have more information about that at radioboston.org. Professor Ferguson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.